This week, Brian Baer joins us from Red Canary for our interview segment. And then in the startup news, we're going to talk about moving to a region, not because of the nice weather, but because of city-owned gigabit networking. Why your startup's marketing strategy may already be doomed. 20 common mistakes, because a lot of our news stories have to be lists. 20 common mistakes first-time entrepreneurs make. How the leather bag startup hit 1 million in sales in 14 months. And in our fun story for this week, 22 most active celebrity startup investors. All that and more on this week's Startup Security Weekly. This is a Security Weekly production. From the top, that's right, this is Startup Security Weekly. I'm your host, Paul Asadarian, broadcasting live from G-Unit Studios in Rhode Island. On the lines via Skype, the beach bum himself from South Carolina, Mr. Michael Santarcangelo. Michael, welcome to the show.
Thanks, brother. I love that intro.
We gave you no warning on that intro either.
That's great. Awesome. I dig it.
Nice job to our production team on putting that together. You got a little fresh look for Startup Security Weekly. Michael, it's awesome, right? Did you want to do a little update first before we jumped into our interview, or it's up to you?
You know what? Let's tease people. So one of the things I'm starting to study a lot is I like people that are transparent about their startups. We do our startup journey. I'm going to share some insights with people on what the last week for me has been like. It's been awesome. And I need some help, and I'm going to make a request to people, but I want to get to our interview. So stick around after our interview and we'll have some candid conversation about some things that I'm learning about my own startup journey and where I could use some help.
Joining us today is the co-founder and CEO at Red Canary, Brian Baer. Brian, welcome to the show.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me.
It's nice to have you on, Brian. And as we established right before the show, the world and especially the security industry is a small space. Lots of commonalities in our cohorts, including an upcoming guest on the show, which you'll have to stay tuned for. So, Brian, I guess first start by, like, how did you get your start in information security and progress to the point where you're now holding the illustrious position of a CEO at a startup?
Great question. So it's actually been a quite fun journey for me in particular. I was back studying actually industrial engineering at Purdue, spent a summer internship at Disney, did some fun things there and came back and just happened to take an interview with a group of guys from Mantech's Computer Forensics and Intrusion Analysis Group. And they showed up and their recruiting pitch was this: hey, if you watch 24, you know how Jack Bauer takes some device, you know, the bad guy's phone, plugs it in, and then that device breaks the encryption and said who he's been talking to? If you want to come build that stuff, come work for us. I, as a college kid, was like, of course, I'm absolutely going to do
that. All in. All in.
Completely in. Immediately changed majors to computer science at their recommendation, went out to the Northern Virginia area, worked with that exact small group that you mentioned. So the Mantech team, many of the original Kairos founders came from there. Red Canary came out of Kairos, as did Carbon Black. And that was really my start. So did that work. And it was really neat to apply cybersecurity to the global war on terror and support, you know, not only our servicemen overseas, but also to support, you know, defense of the homeland.
Excellent. So why don't you tell us a little bit about Red Canary?
Absolutely. So myself and two other co-founders, Chris Rothy and Keith McCammon, all had this idea while we were working at Kairos, where we said, you know, this new endpoint security world is focused on looking at what happens on our systems and then helping you do a faster investigation. And we said, that's just broken. What we need to do is we need to look at everything as it happens and identify the threat before it turns into a giant breach that you have to call Mandiant for. What we realized very early on was almost no one had the ability to build the team of people that spread from both, you know, computer scientists to security engineers to security analysts to do that themselves. And because of that, there's this massive number of companies who have no chance of actually detecting threats before they turn into a breach. So we founded Red Canary, spun it out of Kairos, and built what is today, you know, monitoring over 150,000 endpoints around the world and identifying those attacks.
So, Brian, I and Michael, I apologize. I have to jump right into a technical question, being, you know, somewhat familiar with the space. So, is your product focused on detecting the exploit, detecting how the payload injects into the system, or detecting payload behavior, or a combination, or all three?
Primarily from the time it gets onto the system and then the attacker's movement throughout their kill chain.
Okay.
So what we want to do is look at how do you get onto a system? How is the attacker gaining persistence? What are they actually doing on the system? And we care less about if it's a payload, if it's a piece of malware, and much more broad coverage about is this even an insider threat, or is it someone who's compromised your user's credentials?
And now, does it do this analysis all on the endpoint system, or does it rely on sending something up to the cloud for analysis, or a combination of both?
The latter. So all very detailed endpoint activity comes back to us in the cloud. Mm-hmm. That's where our very creatively named threat detection engine identifies a potential threat. Yeah, we used our one really good name on Red Canary and haven't had a great one since then.
That's awesome. Thank you for describing the technology. It's nice. Now we kind of know where you fit in play.
So let me jump over the natural question on that, Paul. And Brian, we're going to circle back just to be ready, I want to ask about how you guys drew straws to figure out who's going to be CEO versus CTO versus CSO and stuff when there's three of you doing it. But let's go back to the tech for a second, because Paul and I have talked about some of the previous shows, the need to embrace the cloud. But then we've also talked about how some enterprises are kind of like, whoa, not me, not cloud. And one of the things I talk about when people pitch me to write about stuff, I always ask, are you in the cloud? You're one of the few people who said, yeah. In fact, you were more like, hell yeah. So how has that experience been running a startup, doing security, doing most of your processing and offloading in the cloud, or if I've misinterpreted it, correct on what's happening in the cloud? I think it's a huge benefit. Are you finding that there's resistance from people? Did you have to sell them on it? Or is most of the fear and hype against it just that, hype?
So it's one of my favorite areas where when you talk about things you learn with a startup, this is an initial assumption we had where we were completely wrong. So we started and we built Red Canary to not have to run in a cloud like AWS. We built it that if you had to run parts of it on-premise, everything except the security operations center could, because we expected there'd be a lot of pushback. I think we really ended up, we lucked into very good timing in that as we were starting to bring this to our customers, they were all in the middle of moving all of their infrastructure to the cloud. So after 2.5 years of, you know, doing this and going to market, the number of times we've had really hard pushback where people have said, I just can't have this data go to the cloud, I can count on one hand.
Interesting.
That's
not everyone has that experience, I think is what I was going to say.
And I think I'd give a lot of credit to the fact that this founding team, especially Keith McCammon and Chris Rothy, they care so tremendously about security and are so paranoid in how our own security works and what we invest in on that, that it makes it possible to go to those customers and say, look, we run this up in the cloud, but here's the security measures we have in place. Here's what we do so that you can have confidence that ideally your data is safer with us than it might be with you.
How often are you guys having that conversation where the client says, I want to talk to you guys about what you're doing?
Thankfully, it's probably 80% of the time now. And it's the thing I'd love to see. If somebody needs a security startup idea, go figure out how to make everybody's vendor risk and diligence process use a consistent form, because everybody has their own. But we get asked that question all the time. And if you don't ask us about our security, we're going to provide you that information anyway, because that's what you need to be doing to vet your vendors.
Brian, you're in a, in my estimation, correct me if I'm wrong, a fairly crowded space in information security today. By my estimation, there's 40 plus vendors in some form of endpoint protection. Depends on how you slice and dice the market. How do you respond and answer the question, how do you differentiate yourself in this crowded space?
Well, the trend is a good one because a year and a half ago, I think we had over 100. So if we're down to about 40, that's a good start. The interesting thing about Red Canary is that we aren't a pure endpoint detection and response product. We're also not an MSSP. And those two markets are very, very busy. They're very crowded. It's hard to differentiate. Where we sit in the middle as that hybrid of, you know, the best endpoint technology you need, but also the security operations center that you want to build yourself, but you can't, it's actually a much less crowded space. So a lot of what we do is we work with our customers and we say, you know, this is the EDR product you're likely going to buy anyway. And even though there's 40 of those out there, there tends to be three or four of them that everyone is looking at. And then this is what you should do afterward, which is Red Canary is going to do that detection. It's going to do that response, because what we want to do is help our customers be able to respond to more events, right? We want to increase their response bandwidth.
So, Brian, by doing some research, you've taken a seed round and a Series A, correct? Mm-hmm. What were some of the most difficult or the most difficult question that an investor, potential investor, asked you in that process?
I'll be a little tongue-in-cheek. Probably the most challenging question was, when are you going to move the company to either the Bay Area or Boston? Mm. And the answer was, we're not.
Or maybe later, we're going to reveal another city that you could have gone to.
That's right. So exactly. That's interesting that geographic location was really part of some of the thought process behind an investor. What's up with that?
It's very common what we learned, and I don't fault them for it at all. The really active investors and the great investors that you want, they want to be actively involved with your company. They want to be able to drive down the road and see your team. If they want to jump on a plane, they want to be able to jump on a short plane ride to do so. We ended up raising money from Access Venture Partners and Norrell Mosley Partners, which are out of Denver and Atlanta. They are very actively involved. We put them to work pretty hard in supporting Red Canary, and it's great to have them nearby.
So I guess that's a tip for those looking to have a startup is local investors take priority?
I'd say definitely consider it and realize that if you are attempting to raise money from one of the coasts and you're not on the coast, it's going to be more challenging, especially if you want to get that top tier investment partner that you really want on your team.
What did you look for in your investment partners? If you don't mind, like what I want to do is I want to talk a little bit about the process. So one of the things we spend a lot of time talking about is how do we communicate our value? How do we form the pitch? How much time does it take? How much, you know, what kind of effort do you go through to get there? But then one of the other things we've been looking at is how do you pick the partner? I mean, it's not a spray and pray and hoping someone's got cash they're going to throw at you. There's some amount of matchmaking that you go through, or maybe you didn't. So how fill us in on some of the process of being in that startup, saying, okay, we're ready. Actually, maybe even start there. How did you know you were ready? And then what were some of the steps from, okay, we're ready for our Series A? How do you go get that?
So I think for us, what it started with was we wanted to get ready by building a business that actually had a survivable and very profitable model behind it. We didn't want to be one of those startups who was going to burn whatever money they raised very, very quickly. We wanted to have proof that Red Canary does solve a problem for our customers and that there are a lot of people who we can solve that problem for. So the first thing we ended up doing to get ready was we said, we need to go out and sell Red Canary. We need to actually go make a difference for our customers. It is hands down the best thing we ever did, because us as a founding team, we had to learn, how do we go find people that we can make a difference for? How do we convince those companies we can make their security better? How can we help them understand that they can trust us? And it turns out once you do that and you bring them on, now you have a great story that you can take to investors and show them you actually can make a difference.
So if you don't mind, and that's actually really useful. And so let's step back then. What led to the seed round? Did you guys step out as Red Canary before the seed round? And how did you fund that? Or was the seed round what funded you? Or was it splitting out of what you guys had done previously?
So it was simultaneous for us. So when we founded Red Canary, we spun both the three of us founders as well as the original company out of Kairos and took a seed round from them at that time. So it's a little bit of a unique story. We're not three guys who started in a garage. We had the seed funding, the great idea, and the support of a great investment team there to start with.
Actually, so what was that initial conversation like? I mean, was it just sitting around one day going, guys, we should spin this off. We'd like to do it. And they were like, yeah. Because Richard Branson's known for saying, I would rather have smart people providing good products. And if I can help them, I'm going to do it. And if it doesn't work out, they're still part of the team. And if it works out, great. I've been part of the team. Same attitude here? Or like, how did that go?
It's the uniqueness of Kairos from the start. It's why I ended up back there. It was a team of people who wanted to do great security work, but also wanted to, you know, support entrepreneurship, support company development, and spin those ideas off into real companies that stand on their own when that happens. That's what happened with Carbon Black. It's what happened with Red Canary. We looked and we said, we have a real problem. Kairos, this is the idea we have. Let's go run with this and let's do it.
Brian, I want to talk a little bit about your market focus and your target market. And a lot of companies that I speak with, as I do a lot of marketing for companies, and many of them say we want to target the enterprise. And even newer security companies, we're targeting the enterprise. You seem to have a different take on that. You know, who's your target market and why did you choose this market as your target?
Yeah, everybody wants this. You know, especially with a security startup, everybody wants to target the Fortune 100, right? They have big security budgets.
Right.
They'll buy two or three of everything. That's not where we felt we could make the biggest difference, right? The whole point of Red Canary is to make your security better. The people who need help with that more than anything, they're what we call the mid-enterprise. You know, they have 250 employees. They have 1,000, goes up to maybe 5 or 10,000 employees. They have small security teams. They can't build a security operations center themselves. They can't hire endpoint security experts. That's where we can make the biggest difference.
Yeah, we've talked about how many startups will say, well, we want to sell to everyone. And it doesn't surprise me that you're in your second round of funding and you have a very targeted audience that makes sense for your business model. I applaud you on that. That's awesome.
Are you guys related? Because of the way that you spun out and just thinking about Carbon Black and even their location, did that play into your ability to attract some of the Series A attention when you started that process? I mean, sounds like you guys sprang from good lineage. Was that a benefit? Did it hinder you? Or from what you can tell, it just was, and you guys still had to go scrap and fight hard for what you got?
So we definitely had to scrap and fight hard. I think the real benefit that it provided was, you know, when we started, we evaluated a handful of different pieces of endpoint technology on the market, and Carbon Black really had stood out as leading the charge in that space. It was a really good product and a really good early technology partnership of ours, and that allowed us to very quickly, you know, develop a pretty good set of customers who we worked with, provide a ton of value to, which is what a lot of investors look for, right? How excited are your customers? How many of them are going to renew? How many think you're actually making a difference for them?
That's awesome. All right. So how long did it take? Like when you started working on your pitch and your pitch deck, right? Everybody loves to talk about their pitch decks. How'd yours go?
It's funny. If I look back at it now, it seems like a pretty awful looking deck. it probably fits the Red Canary style very well, which is, it's very practical. It tells you this is the giant problem in the market. In fact, my problem slide from the start was the 100+ endpoint security and other security product logos. And our initial pitch of the problem was this market is a disaster. Nobody who's buying a security product has a chance of figuring out which five of them they need.
That's an interesting. I like that approach. I think it's kind of risky because investors kind of get gun shy if you're in a really crowded market, but you were able to very early on in your deck, it sounds like, differentiate yourselves. That's pretty brilliant, Brian. I liked it.
It really was the start. I mean, the start of Red Canary, when we talked about that, was people can't make good security decisions. They don't have the right people. They don't have the bandwidth. We're going to help them do that. We're going to simplify all the complexity of the endpoint security market.
I'm taking notes. I got to modify my pitch deck now.
Well, you know what I think is interesting. So, all right. So when you went in, so let's, and Brian, I'm really enjoying this. So when you were talking to the investors, how many people did, so we're, I'm more focused now on the Series A. How many did you ultimately pitch and talk to before you narrowed it down and got serious talking with folks about term sheets and stuff?
Good question. If I remember my spreadsheet, and it was a giant spreadsheet, we probably talked to 100 to 120, and we in-person pitched probably 60 to 70 of those. It was absolutely a full-time job for many months. It really got to the point where we said, we can't do this anymore. It's a distraction. And almost paused and effectively put it on hiatus and said, this is taking too much time. We're going to focus on making this business even more financially healthy, not by raising investment, but instead by, you know, making a difference and making security better for our customers and growing our number of customers in the family.
Brian, pre-investment and funding rounds, what did you do to get your first like five customers? What advice do you have for startups like myself that are trying to get their first five customers?
Think very hard about the types of customers you want and then build their personal relationships with them. A lot of our initial customers came from people that, you know, not me personally, but Keith McCammon, especially one of our founders, he had done incident response engagements for, or Kairos had supported in some sort of consulting method. And we had the personal relationship to really go to them and say, we're going to make your security better. This is roughly what we think it's going to look like. But to be honest, you're going to be one of the first three customers. So we're going to build it around what actually makes your security better.
In essence, when you describe it that way, it sounds like your first customers are pseudo investors in the company.
Oh, they absolutely are. Honestly, even, you know, your first probably 100 customers are investing in the chance that you're not going to be one of those companies who disappears. You're actually going to do good work with them. And that's why quality is so important, right? We care tremendously and spend far more money than most people do on making sure that we support our customers with everything they're working on.
Oh, that's excellent. And
do you find then that they appreciate that back?
Oh, absolutely. Hands down. It is the best recommendation I could give to anyone. Is invest everything you can into making your customers successful. The most ridiculous example of it was one of our customers had an email delivery issue in the middle of the night, right after they switched their corporate offices. And they had talked to the ISP, they had talked to everybody else involved. And finally, they just said, you know, screw it. I'm going to call Keith. I'm going to call my Red Canary technical account manager. And I'm going to tell him, I don't have a security problem. I have this random problem. I can't figure it out. My business is broken. And it turns out, like, the stars aligned. Keith actually has a background in the telco world. And he said, call your ISP and ask him about this one setting. And sure enough, he called that. And I mean, that guy will be a Red Canary customer for life, right? That's the relationships we want to build.
Okay, let me just point out too, and we can talk about it later, but what Brian just did there, you know, Paul, how we always talk about stories and you got to give me the characters, the conflict and a resolution.
Yep.
Brian, you nailed it. I mean, that was well done. We find a lot of times when we talk to people in technology, they give us chronological listing of facts and you didn't. That's really good.
I think it's really important, again, with those relationships you're building. Right. The entire Red Canary pitch is that you have a problem building your security team and your tech. You're going to trust Red Canary to do that. I'm not going to convince you to do that. You know, our team is not going to convince you to do that with facts. We're going to convince you of that because of how we approach things, how we communicate it, and how we build that trust.
What was the biggest? I'm sorry, Paul. I heard you breathe there, but I beat you to it. So you started out a couple years ago. What would you say? So as you look back at it, right, you already said that the deck has shifted a little bit and you've learned a lot. When you reflect back from the time you guys spun out and started, what would you say is your biggest lesson learned? Security, startup, business, anything. There's got to be one or two things that are kind of like this, big lesson. What'd you learn?
One huge one is that I've learned so much from the time when us founders had to begin selling and the early team had to begin selling. I would say the big thing we learned was the founders have to sell the product. Don't go hire a VP of sales right off the bat. Don't attempt to bring in a consultant to do it. Don't outsource that. You need to be the one who's out there talking to potential customers, turning them into real customers, and supporting them after that.
I like it. I think it's sound advice. I would add on, Brian, that a lot of us with a technology background, such as yourselves, probably could use a hand in the organization and execution. And if you're doing the selling, if you have someone helping you organize that sales process, that's extremely helpful.
Absolutely. And it's not, we did not figure out how to go sell because we sat in a room and looked at each other and said, okay, this is how we're going to sell. Find vendors who you've worked with or find other organizations who you think have built a sales program or built customer relationships that you want yours to be like, right? Ours, we want it to be something where we are seen as the experts by our customers. If you ask us a question on the phone during a sales call, we want to be able to answer that for you and not say, oh, let me go ask my engineer or do that later. You know, find those companies and emulate them. There's a ton of great enterprise software teams that have been built that you can learn from.
On the flip side, Brian, what advice do you have for enterprises that are looking for solutions and maybe aren't inclined to look to the smaller companies or the startups for those solutions? What advice do you have for those companies and how could they benefit from investing really in a startup?
I think the challenge there is that you have to figure out how to evaluate not only what you're looking for, but how do you compare different vendors or different solutions against each other? It's what we've always struggled with in the security world, right? How do I bake off these different products? How do I determine if A, B, or C is actually better? How do I get past just trusting that vendor? And I think that applies whether it's a large established vendor or if it's a brand new startup.
Do you think more so than in other industries that people have been burned by security solutions that didn't pan out?
I don't know if it's more so than other industries or not. I definitely think people have been burned by security products. And what's interesting is I think they've been burned by all types of security products. You know, they've been burned by the startup that flamed out and disappeared. They've been burned out. They've been burned by the good mid-sized company who looked fine, but then got bought by Cisco. And now that product has disappeared, right? I mean, you can get burned by anybody.
It's true. It's true. No, that's also some good advice for folks looking for solutions. So, Brian, what are some of the other security startups in the industry that you either like collaborate with or work with, or ones that you're just like, wow, like they've got a really cool idea and a really cool company?
Yeah, I'll tell you about a couple that I think we've learned over the years really fit a similar approach to caring a lot about our customers and making sure that we can take a very complex problem, do it better than it's been done before, and make it simple and approachable for everyone. The Duo Security guys, you know, Doug and that team over there, they make multi-factor authentication and what's really a lightweight broker. They make it so simple and they're so great to work with. I think you see the same thing from the Signal Sciences guys. Yep. Zane Lackey and the team, you know, came from the Etsy world, did great things there, and now they're
Tyler and I had a conversation the other day. He's actually scheduled to be on the show as well.
Perfect. So, I mean, they make a web app firewall, which used to be something that was a pain in the butt to configure and took a bunch of time and effort. And now we can plug that in, roll that in front of all of our systems, and it's a great high-quality product and team behind it. What's common with them, and you know, we've all kind of laughed amongst us, is we want to start the club, which is security companies who actually care about our customers and want them to be very successful and care more about that maybe than, you know, just growing the top line or, you know, whatever your vanity financial metric is.
You know what I love about that is I'm starting to see, I've been talking a lot about we're at a very positive inflection point in the industry where there's more people coming out saying, how do we run more like businesses? How do we support each other? How do we make a difference with the people that we're working with? And so I'm really encouraged to hear you do that. And I would just say, if that club actually exists, even though I'm in my Groucho Marx phase of not wanting to be a member of any club that would have me, I would join it anyway.
I think it's going to be a great club once we finally get enough time to actually put it together.
Yeah, it'll be like Fight Club, but different.
Yes.
Exactly.
What advice do you have today for those listening to the show that are thinking, hey, I've got an idea, I want to do a startup? What advice do you have for those people?
I'd say first and foremost, find your team, because they're the people who are going to be in the trenches with you from the start, and probably prepare the rest of your life for it, right? I have an awesome wife. I have three kids. They're little kids. You know, I couldn't do any of this if it wasn't for her, them, and the rest of the team around us. You know, interestingly, the three Red Canary founders, we all have three kids. And it can be challenging to do this and build a great company while building a great family at the same time.
As we were speaking before the show, I have three kids. Michael's the crazy one. He's got four kids.
Yeah, and two under five. So it's we keep ourselves busy.
What's more challenging, dealing with the family and maintaining three children in the household, or the startup?
They're both challenging in very different ways. Yeah, I think it's really fun to see kids as they grow up. I give a ton of credit to that. If my wife wasn't awesome, the kids would probably be far harder than the startup. thankfully, I have a great team on both sides, so it's a lot of fun and a great learning experience all around. But yeah, it's completely exhausting.
I put myself in the same boat, and I'd say it's similar in the level of chaos in both environments, yes. Right? So they do share some similarities.
Yeah. In fact, that was one of the comments our investors made at one of our very first board meetings and dinners. They looked around and said, you have three kids, you have three kids, you have three kids. We've never seen like three younger founders with three kids before. You guys are crazy.
You're like, yes, so give us your money. Look what we can do.
That's
we can
right.
make it multiply.
That's it.
We can multiply.
Chris always says this, and it's probably a huge benefit he's brought to the whole team. He said, it's just a constraint, right? If you can work 80 or 90 hours a week and not have a family, you can probably spend your time doing a lot of things you really shouldn't be doing. But when you have a family that you're building at the same time and that you're taking care of, you maybe only have 60 hours a week, right? And so you got to focus on what's best for the company.
That's a good way of looking at it. Certainly, Michael and I have learned that lesson, and we were saying, before the show, that we use tools and manage our time so closely that there's no time between meetings, usually, or things you have to do, right? I mean, you got to block time off and get things done. So, more questions for Brian, Michael?
No, I mean, Brian, I've really enjoyed this. I think when people go back and they unpack a lot of the wisdom that you shared with them, it's been great. I guess maybe the one I would end with is the one piece that we probably haven't touched on. So you guys are a startup. You're a security startup. You take security very seriously. You're also in an area that does have other startups. Do you do outreach with startups that are saying, okay, I got a good idea. All right, I'm the next Internet of Things. Whoa, that could be bad now for investors. All right, I'm the next what? How do we get other startups that are so focused on their minimum viable product and getting some traction and trying to do it, that when we say security, they go, yeah, I'll get there. Any thoughts on how to help them get there a little quicker?
I think the media coverage has actually done us a big favor in that. We obviously, we as a business, it's helped educate the market quite a bit, having the Sony breach, the Target breach, the Home Depot breach, all of that. I think having that type of coverage that says this is a real problem and here's the real impact it's going to have on the world is making people start to care about it. And, the other side of it is compliance and fines and everything is pretty terrible. And since it's government directed, generally pretty poorly implemented, but that does carry a big enough stick where a lot of people care about it. We know several local healthcare and, health tech startups who are going to be working with HIPAA protected data. And I give them a ton of kudos because they have 15 people, but they understand I need to spend, effectively $100,000 to $200,000 a year on the people and the tech that I need to defend that data. As a consumer, that's great. It's awesome to see that shift taking place. Not fast enough in most places, but still it's going in the right direction.
Fantastic. Brian, thank you very much for appearing on Startup Security Weekly. It was awesome talking with you.
Great. Thanks a lot, guys. Great to be here and look forward to hearing more.
Awesome. Thanks, Brian. Take a short break. Come back. Cover the startup news for this week. Welcome back, everyone, to Startup Security Weekly. Michael and I are here to talk about the startup news for this week. And admittedly, our show notes are all borked.
Refresh. I fixed them.
Did you? Okay.
I fixed them. Yeah, they're fixed. And as you refresh, I told people I want to update them on the journey. And you know what? I'm so glad we're doing this after Brian. Now, let me start by saying Brian was suggested to us by you when we said, hey, who do you want to see on the show? One of you reached out and said, I think Brian would be a great guest. Yes, Brian was a great guest. And I think there's a lot of insight, a lot of real raw stuff there that was really cool. And what was neat was a lot of it was resonating right where I was at. So I wanted to ask, actually, if you're watching this show, I wanted to ask for your help. Here's what I got. I'm starting the next cohort of the Straight Talk Leadership Experience next week. And so what's cool is, like, if you look at launching something, you look at doing it online, I've done a couple things, and it's nice because it sounds like it matches up with what Brian was talking about. And Paul, I mean, obviously I'd love, you know, this could be more of a discussion, but let me frame it real quick and then, and ask people to help out in a couple different ways here. I put up a course landing page. I'll put it in the show notes. If you come to securitycatalyst.com, it's actually right on the homepage. And that's also where the new 7 steps to Straight Talk is. So I got that updated. In fact, that's kind of what happened. I got to the end of last week and I'm at that point, Paul, we talk about pitching and explaining stuff. Mm-hmm. So I've gone from people listening to me saying, oh, that's nice. And what I learned in a lot of those early conversations was if you kept talking, you'd hear what people were trying to solve. So like I would say, well, this is a way to bring people together and you can learn what they're trying to do. And people are like, yeah, it's great. Here's what I need. I need to break down barriers. I don't know where to focus. I need clarity on my focus. I need this. I need that. And so I started listening to people and starting to show them how that works. So, you know, Brian talks about his pitch deck changing. The way I explain stuff, the way I talk about it totally changed. So from cohort 1 to cohort 2, I just put up what we would call a landing page. I've got a new landing page up. I put some video on it. I would really love you to come and to check it out. And there's kind of two parts to it. A, if you want to join this next cohort, I'd love you to be part of it. I've only got room for about 30 people. And so here's the other thing too. And I like the way that Brian explained this. So here's one of the things that's happening. I'm trying to learn how to run a business that's not just me consulting anymore. I'm trying to figure out how do I and start to build a team, but how do I do something that elevates and accelerates you as a leader and helps you communicate better as we do stuff. So you start learning about content marketing, you start learning about funnels and automation and all sorts of other stuff. And I got to tell you two things. At first, it's daunting. I know, Paul, you've offered to help with some of that because you've learned pieces to it. And I actually launched my very first Facebook ad today, which I'm sure I didn't do properly, and I will come to you begging for advice shortly.
Most people don't, in my estimation, and I certainly learned a lot, don't get their first Facebook ad right. And hopefully you only spent like $20 and
I did $20. I cast the net wide. I went fast and simple and said, good, let me throw it in there. See what happens. We'll learn from it. We'll start getting better with it. But it's kind of neat. So here's the other piece to it then. When you start doing it, and look, if you've signed up for a mail list, you get this, right? It's the whole, well, it's closing on Monday. This is your last chance. But and let's say you jump in on it and you're like, dude, there's nothing here. Like there wasn't really scarcity. You're full of crap. And so I've been leery with a lot of that stuff because I don't want to come across as salesy. I want to be like, look, I'm here for you. So what's interesting is when I did it over the summer, it was the, all right, let me just go and I'm going to leap and we're going to figure it out. And a bunch of people came along for the ride. And as Brian pointed out, I have and I will continue to devote myself to those people. But if you go to the site, you'll see some of the things that they've read, that they've written about their experience in the cohort, which has only helped me make it better. So then I started adding more stuff into it. So what I've found actually is I kind of went the other way. A lot of people, when they try to create these programs, they say, okay, now how do I get it to scale to 1,000 people? I'm going the other way. How do I keep it to 30 to 40 people? How do I give people a one-to-one coaching experience every single week? And one of the new questions I'm getting from people is, well, but Michael, I'm really busy. I don't even know if I have time for this. So I've started to break down and explain to people how all those different pieces work. So here's what you could do to help me. Go take a look at the page, check it out, and then be brutal with me. Did it resonate with you or not? And if it didn't, why? I've had some people come back to me and say, well, you know, I'm not a leader yet. Yeah, you are. Trust me. If you're watching this show and paying attention, you're a leader. But let me know if there's a question that I didn't answer, if there's something you'd like to see better, if there's some piece to it. Because what I'm also doing is each of these cohorts, I'm considering the people who join me as an investor. So they're giving me value. They're helping me make this better. They're serving as the proof. They're creating the testimonials. They're helping me shape it. So the price goes down. But as this continues, each cohort, I'm going to step the price up. It's not a game. It's not a gimmick. I know where the price needs to be. In fact, I'm going to put together some stuff this weekend. I'm be very transparent with people that the price is going to be somewhere between $5,000 and $6,000 a cohort. But I'm going to prove to you that you're going to get 300% back of that investment. In fact, I'm going to include your time in that. And that's one of the things I'm going to put out this weekend and start showing people. And I want to be very transparent to make sure that I'm delivering that level of value consistently. So right now I'm pricing it around $1,200. I'd like to understand, you know, where do you sit with that? How do you feel with it? And then if you like what you see, but maybe you're really just not in a spot to do anything on it, introduce it to a friend. Help me get a little bit of lift. Help me get it to the people that can do something with it that are going to benefit from it. And then we'll all keep learning. And while you're on my site, you'll see I put up, Paul, remember I promised I was going to do all those resources?
Yeah.
Since last show, I have worked 12 hours a day, every single day. I have a brand new resource section up. And in the resource section, remember we've talked before about the five lenses of value. So how do I know what your value is? Or how do I value my time? Or how do I measure this properly? Or how do I communicate effectively? That is all up. Absolutely free of charge. No gates, no nothing. That's up on the site. And I'll tell you what, a bunch of the clients I talked to this week thanked me for that. They said it made it easier for them to make the sale. So you know how you and I talk about putting more stuff out there and helping the community and making that type of a difference?
So important.
I am basically a week behind where I wanted to be in really trying to promote this cohort. Because like I'm on one hand, I had a couple people sign up today. I've got like 30, maybe a few less spots. Last week would have been the right time to do that. But I looked and I said, you know what? Let me go build out this 7 steps process. Let me go rebuild the homepage so it's more clean on what I do. Let me go show people how I work with them better. Let me go revamp this. And so I put a lot of time into it. And what I'm starting to see is that made a difference. And so from a startup perspective, I don't know yet how that's going to work. And that's kind of why I'm asking for your help if you're watching this and take a look at it. And, you know, again, if you want to join me, I'd love for you to be in that. But if not, I'd love for you to take a look at it and tell me the questions that you have, because I'm going to be building out the showcase and I'm going to be learning from Paul. And we're going to bring you more of this. And this is how I'm going to be able to give more value both back into the startups and into the security world. And we're going to show people how to do this type of stuff pretty consistently. And so I'm really excited about this. I'm completely terrified. We talk about that roller coaster that we're on.
That's good.
And, you know, it's so anyway, that's kind of the story I've got coming into it. So like you ask about managing the week and everything else. Mm-hmm. My wife is a saint. And she's been pretty good at just taking the kids out. They go to the playground.
Yes.
And it's been really helpful. So,
well, anyway, you know, it could be helpful to get a celebrity investor, like maybe Snoop Dogg. Can you imagine the pitch for Snoop Dogg? I mean, Snoop Dogg's one of my idols. I don't know. I just he's cool. He's so cool. But it's kind of funny. Coincidentally enough, he's backed several cannabis startups, including.
That surprises me.
Right? Go figure. Including Mary Jane, Leafs by Snoop, Funk Sack, and Ease with a Z. I had to throw just something ridiculous in there. We haven't had a ridiculous story. I do it a lot on Paul Security Weekly. We just had to throw it in there. You know, kind of on the flip side of that, this is
Iron Man is in there. Robert Downey Jr.
Yeah, like when you ask, which celebrity would you choose as your parents, right? Like Robert Downey Jr. is up there for dad. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, there's a few people on this list that I wouldn't want anything to do with, just to be fair.
Justin Bieber. I'm not sure how much of a
There's a few.
50 Cent.
Tyra Banks. She's got a little bit of a temper, but that wouldn't be horrible.
Maybe not. It wouldn't be horrible having her in the boardroom either, for a lot of reasons. Yeah, so there's a lot of celebrities that do startups, which I thought was just interesting. It's kind of a fun list to go through and imagine some of these people investing in your startup.
Can you imagine what that pitch is like? You're like, oh my God, I'm pitching you.
Yeah, hey, yeah.
But you got to play it really cool, right? You're like, yo, what's up? Yeah, I'm here to pitch you. Hey, can you give me this autograph
real quick? Can we take a selfie real quick?
Yeah, don't ask for the autograph, man. Don't ask. All right, we've been talking about time, so it's interesting. It fits into our arc for the week. You've got some great stories in there. I picked three.
Okay.
And what's interesting is they all kind of work together. So this is what set it off. I saw an article earlier this week, how I decreased my weekly office hours from 40 plus to less than 8. And look, I know everybody's in love with Tim Ferriss. I have nothing against Tim Ferriss, but what I've seen is he does the 4-hour work week, and so everybody's like, oh, well, I should only work 4 hours a week. So I looked at this with a skeptical look of, you're working 40 hours plus like the rest of us, and now you're working less than 8 and you're a CEO? Mm. What? Yeah, here's the thing, though.
I don't know about that.
This is what I liked about it. And actually, she mentions that she has 4 kids. So I went, well, hold on.
There you go.
If I could work 8 hours a week and have 4 kids, yeah, that'd be kind of great. But here's a couple of things that she did that I thought were important. First of which is she created space to forge the new path. And then a couple other things she said she has 5 things. I hired strategically. That's going to be one of the themes we work through. We started documenting our processes. You and I have talked about this a couple times.
Mm-hmm.
Created space, scheduled time for being away from the office. This one of the things I've done, you and I have talked about this a lot. I don't take calls before a certain hour. Yep. I will work with people pretty much until I fall asleep at night if they need me to. But I know now that I am really creative. In fact, I don't know if I want to admit this too much, but I've been getting up at like 4:30 every morning. Dude, I'm full of energy. I have clarity of focus. Nobody's up in the house for 2-3 hours. I get so much stuff done.
I'm up at 5, and I've got a 5-month-old in my arms and my phone in the other. And if I can get him to go to sleep, I've had to learn how to be productive with one hand on my phone.
Hey, but still, right? I mean, that's kind of cool.
But I made strides, right? Flipboard is awesome. I figured if I can get through reading my stories and tagging them for all the shows in Flipboard, I wrote a Python script. I spent the time and wrote that and automated it. And that's what allows me to be prepared for my shows without having when I get in the office now. I don't have to worry about that because I've done some of that. It's harder when you got to feed them and be on the phone at the same time. He doesn't really like the one-handed thing. I'm working with him on that. Like, Mom, work with me, Luke.
You should get some duct tape out. Duct tape that.
Well, there's a startup that makes the thing that goes on the chest that holds the bottle. Yeah, I got to get one of those.
Yeah, we should interview them. That's the startup.
Yeah.
But what I love about that is what you're saying is you documented your processes. Now, how do you do about this other part? Scheduling time away from the office. Right now, I'm working out of the house, and I'm pretty sure that when we move, I'm going to get office space outside of the house. I've had office space outside of the house. I've had it in the house. I like the convenience of having it in the house, but then you feel like you're always working. And what I found was that when I had space, I could be like, all right, I'm done. I'm out. You have space. You have a beautiful studio. Does that work for you? Do you find that to be a big benefit?
I wouldn't have it any other way. I highly recommend it. I mean, I worked from home for a long time as well. And largely that was a time when my house was mostly empty during the day. But now not so much. So now it would just be chaos and having that separate, you know, work time.
I'll have to be the Southern studio. That's what we'll do.
Absolutely.
We'll be the Southern studio and I'll get the hell out. The other one that she put on that I liked was we improved communication. You know, it's fascinating. Obviously when you do straight talk, people, it's actually kind of funny. People associate that instantly with, oh, that's how to communicate better. And the funny part is I actually have to say, well, yeah, but it does a lot of other stuff. And what's interesting is a lot of people will say to me, well, I don't have that problem. I mean, we're good. I'm like, okay, well, what this really does is, and I go through like taking friction out of communication, give them some examples. We talk about clarity, priority. And then suddenly they go, you know what? I have that problem. I have that problem everywhere. Okay, let's think about this differently. And so I think somebody's saying, hey, how do we communicate?
Yeah.
And are we communicating well? And it, like she's talking about, look, I used email, I used texting, I used Google Chat, you know, and then now they use Slack. We're using Slack. Frankly, I got 6 different communication things open right now.
My take on that, Michael, is not. I think improving communication is too broad. I think where I'm at now, and I'm probably going to make a big push from now to the end of the year, is being able to minimize having to communicate as much. And if you've done that other step of documenting your processes, I'm looking at technology that actually lets you communicate less and or more efficiently, right?
You know what I love
take
about
out,
this?
Take out some of that communication. Calendly was awesome. We talked about that startup front. That's awesome. Ticketing system. Like now I'm kind of realizing how integral technology is. But now you're going to have to put investment in time up front in defining your policies and procedures, and then extend that when you adopt the technology, attaching procedures to that and documenting your process. But once you do that, when you do communicate, like it really counts, right?
You know what I love about that is that, I woke up this morning and I went, oh, wait a minute. One of the big questions that's coming this week is, and it started as tongue in cheek, but I've had it now 4 or 5 times. Can you help me get out of these stupid meetings I got to be in? And every time I say, yeah, absolutely. And then I actually had somebody send me an email and say, wait, how? Like, well, okay, I'm in. How do I do that? And I'm thinking about how to like build a way to start people do it. But just listening to you talk about it, yeah, you got to put some time up front in. So you know how you choose which ones to do, right? If you run through those 5 questions of straight talk. So what's the problem you're trying to solve? Mm-hmm. And unless it's just you, don't do that in a vacuum. Ask a couple other people, right? Make sure that you're really looking at the right problem. Are you ready? Do you have the right technology in place? Do you have the time? Do you have the money to pay for it? Is it a subscription? Is there a startup cost, right? There's a lot of stuff to go through it. And then what's the value? When you do that, what's that better tomorrow look like? And I think that's a really good way. And then they keep looking for ways to improve. So anyway, I don't know if you're going to get down to 8 hours, although what she said is I now work less than 8 hours each week at the office.
Yes.
Mm. Okay. But hey, I don't think that's a bad idea.
I got,
there's 2 other stories in here. I don't know if we'll have time for them, but what I wanted to point out was one of them basically said, hey, be nice to people. But what it's really saying underneath it is give them a purpose. Make them feel like they're part of what you're doing. And then that's contrasted a little bit by saying, look, you don't have to fit for culture. But that's actually not what he's saying. It's actually saying, don't be stupid about it, but fit for the right position and job. So if you understand what you're doing and you can give people that better tomorrow and show them where they fit and give them a reason to be passionate at work, then it's easier to find those right people. And then you're going to get where you need to be.
I will put some of our stories in for next week too. The one I wanted to talk about was the location of your startup. Brian brought up some great points, and two of which Brian hit on were your team, right? So your location is going to define who you can get for your team. I mean, people can work remotely, but there's something to be said for your startup team working in the same location. He talked about where your investors are located in, or a proximity to your investors as being important. The article I found where startups are moving to Chattanooga, Tennessee, because it has city-owned gigabit network. So your internet connectivity certainly plays into it. And I never considered those, how important location was, and then considered those 3 criteria for your location. And look, I don't know how important it is in the grand scheme of things. However, something to think about if you're a startup or thinking
about
a startup.
But here's what I think about, right? Because so I live in Myrtle Beach, and frankly, we're looking at moving closer to Charlotte. And part of that's too to be closer to air, not just for me outbound, but also for people to come inbound. When we used to live outside of New York, going to an airport and being able to fly anywhere direct was a really nice convenience. I realized now flying from this airport, it's connections everywhere. And you basically got to tack a day on either side. But what I think is interesting, though, is that there's a pretty good startup community in Charleston. And if you look at it, it's a lot around digital. It's around a lot around arts and entertainment, bringing that stuff together. So I started looking at how do you build that? How do you build those communities? How do you build those cultures into an organization or into an area? And what I think is interesting is, and I'm going to actually, this has got me interested enough, I'm going to go dig into it. I think Chattanooga, probably somebody said, hey, what can we do that would be attractive? Now, what I think is cool about it is they go, okay, we'll go build them cheap, fast internet. That's awesome. But you know what happens then, right? You get those first couple startups. Well, then it's easy to get a couple more. So they can still broadcast out, no pun intended, that they've got this fantastic gigabit Ethernet or connectivity rather. But what's going to happen on top of that? They're going to start bringing companies in. People are going to start there for that. But then if they can back that up, I mean, they've got a great picture there. And they can say, oh, and by the way, we've got a good startup community. And we start working together and check out this little downtown area. And here's where the restaurants pop up. And they're connecting all that stuff together. If they're doing that, that's going to be a model to keep paying attention to.
Absolutely.
I like it.
In the interest of time, we're going to cut this episode short. Thanks, everyone, for listening and watching. Thanks to our special guest, Brian Baer from Red Canary. And, of course, always thanks to Michael Santarcangelo. Thanks, everyone, again, for listening and watching. We'll see you next week on Startup Security Weekly.